WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're remembering Robert Kennedy, who was assassinated 30 years ago, just after winning the 1968 California presidential primary. He died on June 6th. A little later in the program, we'll hear from his youngest son, Max. Our first guest, journalist Jack Newfield, traveled with Kennedy from November of 1966 until the assassination. Newfield was covering Kennedy for the Village Voice and writing a biography, which was published in 1969. Newfield has just adapted that book into a three-part documentary series which debuts Sunday on the Discovery Channel. During Kennedy's political career, he was chief counsel to the Senate Rackets Committee, campaign manager for his brother Jack, attorney general, U.S. senator from New York, and a presidential candidate. Jack Newfield says that Robert Kennedy wasn't like other politicians. I asked what made him different.
I guess it was the capacity to grow and change. He's one of the few politicians, and he was just a politician. He wasn't a religious figure or intellectual or an artist. He was a politician, but his capacity to change and grow and listen to people and be moved by personal experiences and be open to new ideas and to reconsider his own positions and philosophies is what made him so unique to me, because I think most politicians get worse when they're in power, become more compromised, more cynical, more jaded, more conservative, more trapped in the office. And he was the opposite. He became more radical in office, more willing to reconsider what he thought about Vietnam, what he thought about race and class. And he was so, I think, devastated by his brother's assassination that it opened him up intellectually and emotionally to whole new worlds. In the months after his brother's murder, he rarely went to the office as attorney general. He stayed home all day. He would read Aeschylus and Shakespeare and Camus and Emerson, and he had never thought who he was until his brother was killed. I think he just thought his job was to be the enforcer, the hatchet man for his brother, and whatever his brother's goals were became his goals, and whatever his brother's politics were became his job to implement them.
And you had about, I think you say, 150 hours of conversations with Robert Kennedy while you were writing your book on him. I'm sure you talk with him about the impact of his brother's assassination. And I'm wondering if you talk with him about why he decided to get deeper into politics after his brother's death. I think a lot of people might have decided to leave politics if their brother, who was president, was assassinated.
I think he, in that period of 6 to 8 months where he was basically non-functional, like a wounded animal, not really in this world all the time. I think Bob considered teaching, going into journalism, running a foundation. But I think in the end, that family obligation to continue his brother's mission, to pick up his brother's fallen standard, became predominant in his thinking. And he was convinced in August of 1964 to resign as Attorney General and run for the Senate in New York, in what was a very difficult election against a decent, moderate Republican named Kenneth Keating. But I think it was to continue the mission that swayed his thinking to remain in public life, to remain in politics, that Kennedys are not quitters, Kennedys don't give up. I'm not going to be chased out of the public arena by the specter of assassination. And I think he became very fatalistic and in some ways perhaps reckless about his own safety and security when he did get back into politics, because he never had any security with him that was armed. There was no Secret Service protection. He and I would ride on the shuttle between New York and Washington, and there was nobody with him. But I think he dealt with that, the murder of his brother, with this kind of fatalism and a kind of Camus-like view that life is absurd. You can't control fate and destiny. If my brother was killed with Secret Service protection and all the law enforcement protection available, no one can protect me. If my number is up, it's up. And I think he went through life with that attitude after Dallas.
Did you ever challenge him on that?
No, I think it was first it was very hard to talk to him about anything involving his brother's death. For years afterwards, he couldn't even read newspaper stories about the Warren Commission report or Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans. Only by the middle of 67 could he have a conversation or read a newspaper or a news magazine story that dealt with Dallas. It was like an amputation to him that was raw and unbandaged, the loss of his brother. I know that with three of his closest aides in 1967, he did talk to them about who might have killed his brother, and he wanted them to look into it, although he couldn't emotionally handle doing it himself. He did ask Frank Mankiewicz and Richard Goodwin to become experts on the various investigations, and he did tell Goodwin and Mankiewicz that he thought organized crime was behind his brother's murder, and we do have one soundbite from Goodwin repeating that conversation he had with Bob in 67.
How compatible do you think his personality was with the life of a politician?
I think he had aspects of his personality that were not so compatible. He had his deep streak of black Irish melancholy, and he was occasionally depressed. He loved, privacy and just being able to stay home and read on a Sunday afternoon. He did not enjoy the crummy little rituals of politics, of glad-handing local county leaders or chatting up potential contributors. Until he became senator, he was the guy in the back room. He was the manager. He was not the racehorse. And I think he did not have the kind of amazing glibness that President Clinton has, or most politicians. He stammered and stuttered, and his hands trembled behind the lectern, and he was not your normal conventional politician in a lot of aspects to his personality. But I think he forced himself, once he decided that he had to remain in politics, to adapt and adjust to the rules of the game.
What do you think his greatest accomplishments were?
I would say number one, as Attorney General, recognizing the dimensions of the organized crime problem in this country and breaking the back of the mob, cleaning up the Teamsters, prosecuting Jimmy Hoffa, at a time where that was controversial, was considered anti-union in some circles. Hoffa was kind of a romanticized outlaw in some quarters. But I think he targeted the biggest crime bosses in the country for prosecution, Carlos Marcello, Santo Trafficante, particularly Sam Giancana. At a time when the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, said the mafia didn't exist. There is no mafia. And Hoover would not assign agents to investigate organized crime, which I think Robert Kennedy, from his years as counsel to the McClellan Committee, understood that, I think, in 1960 was the absolute zenith of the mob's power in America. They controlled Las Vegas casinos, unions, a lot of white-collar industries and leisure. They had a big control in the record industry and boxing. And he saw this, and his work laid the foundation for the RICO statute. And I think his second great accomplishment was in the last, probably the last 8 weeks of his life, after Martin King was killed, to see that he had this moral, historical obligation to try to fill the vacuum created by Dr. King's murder, and to become the tribune of the poor and the powerless, which he did increasingly so during the 68 election. And then third, his gradual recognition that the Vietnam War was wrong and unwinnable and draining immense resources out of our cities, and that his own brother had been in error, which he does admit in the speech we show in the film, in thinking the Vietnam War was winnable. And I think willingness to oppose the war, admit his own and his brother's error, and risk everything in a run for the presidency to stop the war, I think I would say those are his three longest-lasting and distinctive accomplishments.
My guest is journalist Jack Newfield. He wrote a 1969 book about Robert Kennedy, which he's adapted into a three-part documentary series which premieres Sunday on the Discovery Channel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist Jack Newfield. He co-produced a three-part documentary on Robert Kennedy for the Discovery Channel. Newfield covered Kennedy and traveled with him for the last 2.5 years of Kennedy's life. When you were following Robert Kennedy on his presidential campaign, did you think he was going to win?
I did not actually think he was going to win until like the last half hour of his life. It's that last night in California. He had lost the Oregon primary the week before, partly because he supported gun control in a state with a lot of hunters, which, given the events recently in Oregon 30 years later, has a certain irony. But he had lost in Oregon. Everything was riding on California. He had a win in California. And the same day, there was a primary in South Dakota, which is the state Hubert Humphrey was born in, although he later became the senator for Minnesota. And that night, the last night of his life, he not only won California by 5 percentage points, he also won in South Dakota in about a half hour before he went down to the ballroom to claim his victory. He had a phone conversation with Mayor Daley of Chicago, and Mayor Daley all but promised to throw the Illinois delegates to Bobby at the convention in August in 1968. And I think he said to me and Pete Hamill at that point, Daley is the ball game, and I think we have Daley. And then one of the most moving things for me was the night before his funeral, I went into St. Patrick's Cathedral with a group of friends that included Tom Hayden, who was then a leader of Students for a Democratic Society, and was organizing the protest at the 1968 convention. And I was asked to stand vigil at the casket at some point in the middle of the night, and Mayor Daley was there. And he and I, who did not admire each other, were both standing over the casket of Robert Kennedy and tears running down our cheeks. And Tom Hayden, who was further back in St. Patrick's, I could hear him crying. And then 10 weeks later, when the Democratic Party was almost destroyed by the armies led by Tom Hayden in the street and the Chicago police working for Mayor Daley, I thought back to that moment, that Robert Kennedy was the only possible person who could have unified Mayor Daley and Tom Hayden and myself behind one candidacy, and that those riots and violence never would have happened if Bob had not been killed. And I think if he had been nominated, he certainly would have defeated Richard Nixon. And that's a gigantic fork in the road to get Richard Nixon instead of Robert Kennedy.
Where were you when Robert Kennedy was murdered?
I was in the fifth floor of the hotel. I was watching. He went downstairs, and I wanted to avoid the crush of people. And John Lewis, who's in the film and is a close friend of mine, who is now a congressman from Atlanta, he and I stayed behind to watch the victory speech on TV in a suite on the fifth floor that Bob had just vacated. And we watched it on television in the hotel. And then we ran downstairs when we realized that shots had been fired. And later that night, me and John and Cesar Chavez went to the hospital, and which is where it hit me that that this was Robert Kennedy's coalition, and people like Chavez and John Lewis were now orphans in history. That I felt Robert Kennedy's presidency would have been the logical climax of the 1960s, that everything that had happened for 8 years was pointing towards Robert Kennedy's presidency to end the Vietnam War, and it was just aborted in front of our eyes. It was as Marshall Gans, who was an organizer for Chavez, says in the film, as Robert Kennedy, as the gunshots rang out and you knew what happened, he said, "I could feel history slipping through my fingers."
Has there been any information about Robert Kennedy that has surfaced in the years since his death that have led you to reconsider your evaluation of him as a political leader or as a man?
Not in any large way. I mean, doing this film, I spent a lot of time investigating the plots to assassinate Fidel Castro, and the one plot in particular that angered Robert Kennedy, the hiring of the mafia by the CIA to assassinate Castro. And
the same guys who he had been prosecuting were the guys the CIA had hired, like,
right,
Sam Giancana.
Yes. And but I'm convinced that he did everything in his power to stop that, because he was outraged by it. He had created this feud with Frank Sinatra by moving President Kennedy's stay in Palm Springs from Sinatra's house to Bing Crosby's house, because Giancana, the crime boss of Chicago, was staying at Sinatra's house. He hated Giancana. He told his assistant, John Siegenthaler, to redouble the efforts to get Giancana when he found out the CIA had paid him and Traficante money to murder Castro. So I think that what he did in that case was honorable, to try to stop the plots, although I think the CIA lied to him and told him the plots involving the mafia were over. And in the film, I chose to go on camera myself and to criticize Robert Kennedy for the wiretapping of Martin Luther King. And then I say it was indefensible then, and it's still indefensible now, but I knew that in 1968.
Let me get back to Giancana for a second. John Kennedy was alleged to have had an affair with Giancana's lover, so I can't imagine how Robert Kennedy would have felt about that. He had to know.
Oh, he certainly did know. I think Hoover made it clear to him in by mid-62 that President Kennedy and Sam Giancana were sharing the same mistress.
So what did Robert Kennedy make of that? Did you talk to him about that ever? Do you know?
No. Well, nobody knew about Judy Exner until the church committee hearings in 1975. I certainly did not know, and nobody knew about it while Robert Kennedy was alive. It came out 8 years after he was dead.
So is this something that troubles you, or that you'd really love to hear him?
It doesn't trouble me, but I'm very curious to know how he dealt with it, what he said to his brother.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were all of these rumors about Robert Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
I looked into it as much as you could, and I didn't. At the end, I decided not to get into something that was unknowable. There were allegations that Robert Kennedy was in Malibu the night Marilyn Monroe committed suicide, August 4th, 62. And if that had been true, we certainly would have put that in the film. And I did a lot of research, and the LAPD had done a confidential report to investigate whether that was true, and they proved there were no... Robert Kennedy, the night of Monroe's death, was giving a speech to the Bar Association in San Francisco, and there were no helicopters rented that went from San Francisco to L.A. People who were with Robert Kennedy that night said he was in San Francisco all night and went to church in the morning at 6 o'clock. So I think there is a lot of interest and a lot of mystery, but some things are just unprovable if you really have a standard for truth and knowledge beyond rumor.
What was Robert Kennedy's lasting effect on you?
Well, one, he just educated me a lot about integrity in public life. And he became, for me, he is the standard by which I think all politicians should be judged. I think people who were born after 1968 should not think that Carter or Bush or Bill Clinton or Al Gore is the highest standard for public service. I think they have to see someone like Robert Kennedy and his degree of principle and integrity and capacity for growth and sense of humor and lack of hubris and willingness to be transformed by experience. I think you have to see Robert Kennedy before you can really measure this generation or the next generation of candidates who want your vote.
Jack Newfield. He co-produced the documentary Robert Kennedy, A Memoir, which premieres Sunday night on the Discovery Channel. Newfield is now a political columnist for the New York Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.